You are listening to a Bible talk recorded at the 2004 Western Christadelphian Bible School at Manuka. This is the second class in a series given by Brother John Popel on the subject, The Suffering of a Righteous Man. This class is titled, The Wilderness Journey.
This morning, then, we'll look at Job under the heading, The Wilderness Journey. And we'll see particularly why that's appropriate in a few minutes, perhaps. But first of all, let's just familiarize ourselves with the structure of the book of Job, because Job is actually a very heavily structured book. What we find is that Job's three friends take it in turns, in three cycles, to speak. So there is a heavy degree of choreography, if you like, in the speeches that occur in the main body of the text of Job. The first three chapters merely just introduce, kind of set the scene for what's going on, and the last chapter, chapter 42, is a conclusion and a form of epilogue. And so the rest of the action really takes place between chapters 4 and 41. So I've shown it on this slide here. The chapter numbers in the book are shown in green, and the speakers are shown in various colors. And so you can get the idea, if it hasn't been made apparent to you before, of the almost play-like setting of the book, how choreographed each speaker is. So Job gives an opening speech almost to the world in chapter 3, and then Eliphaz, you can see, is the first of the three friends to speak. He speaks in chapters 4 and 5. Job replies in chapters 6 and 7. Bildad speaks for the first time in chapter 8, Job replies in chapters 9 and 10, and so on and so forth through the lines. And so each of the three friends speaks three times each until you get to the third round, when Eliphaz speaks for the third time in chapter 22, Job replies in chapters 23 and 24, Bildad starts to speak in chapter 25, and he doesn't really, I think it's fairly obvious, he doesn't really get more than a few words out before Job interrupts him. So Job cuts off the pattern. People often suppose that it's Elihu who cuts off the pattern, but that's not true. Job cuts off the pattern, and he cuts Bildad short in his third speech, and then he speaks, indeed he speaks, seems to give two separate speeches, meaning that his total number of general speeches is three, and then there is some silence, perhaps, before Elihu speaks, and he speaks at length, and then God also delivers two speeches that we'll consider in hopefully great detail on Thursday, and the book concludes. So there's the sort of the book at a glance in terms of the content of the debate that's going on between Job and his three friends. That's just to give you an overview of the book itself. And by the way, I should make clear that all these slides will be available online. So if you're online, you can just pull them off and download them. You don't need to copy down everything. So take whatever notes you feel are helpful, because I'm going to say things that don't appear on the slides, that's for sure. All the address and details I will put up. If I were organized, I'd already have it, but I will go away and do it, so it'll be maybe put up at a slide at the end of tomorrow's class, something like that, that might be helpful. In fact, the book of Job is so structured, so highly structured and choreographed, that many of the higher critics have been prompted to say, well, maybe it's just a play. Maybe it's a drama. The lessons are from God and the lessons are to be learned, but this is actually a dramatic play much more than its actual history. And so we will take a couple of minutes to consider that. And I realize now I've left my Bible behind. That wasn't too clever. Yeah, Bible talks often go better with a Bible. That's a good idea. And these are the reasons why some of the critics suppose or propose the notion that it's only a drama or a play. First of all, there is a very high degree of structure. In other words, it just doesn't seem like normal conversation. It just doesn't seem like a normal flow of talking that everyone should speak in such a sort of carefully arranged way. The second reason, perhaps unsurprisingly, is that the events that happen are themselves so unlikely. I mean, the idea that the fire of God fell from the sky and burned up the sheep and the servants, and I, a servant, am the only one who has escaped to tell you. And while he was yet speaking, another messenger came and said, and delivers a story that's equally improbable, where indeed yet again he is the sole survivor who arrives exactly as all of the other messengers arrive coincidentally. So that seems a very unlikely thing to happen, and also that the language of the speeches is much more poetic than ever it is prosaic. For example, I'm just reading from, I think this is Eliphaz who is speaking, and he talks in such a way, "Submit to God and be at peace with him. In this way prosperity will come to you. Accept instruction from his mouth and lay up his words in your heart. If you return to the Almighty, you will be restored. If you remove wickedness far from your tent and assign your nuggets to the dust, your gold of Ophir to the rocks in the ravines, then the Almighty will be your gold, the choicest silver for you." And so on and so forth. The language is highly poetic. It's not the normal way in which, if we're speaking off the cuff one to another, our sentences would be constructed. So these are the reasons that are proposed that Job may be just a drama or a play. I don't ascribe to that interpretation myself, though I understand that this is sensible reasoning. Let's look at a couple of limitations or rebuttals to that argument, or those arguments. First of all, let's address the middle point, that the events are seemingly highly unlikely. Well, yes, indeed, they might seem to be highly unlikely. In fact, yes, indeed, they are highly unlikely. But why should that surprise us? The Bible tells us this was the hand of God at work. And when the hand of God is at work, then coincidences do occur with extreme convenience to the human eye. For example, the parting of the Red Sea. How convenient was that? I mean, in terms of its timing, you have 1,000,000 or 600,000 or whatsoever Israelites fleeing, and they arrive at the beach and gather there, and at that precise moment is when the waters part, when Moses calls for them to part. Not only that, but there's just enough time for them, every single one, to get across safely, but not a single one of their pursuers, however many there were, of the Egyptians, can make it to the far side before the waters close and they're all drowned. So the events of the parting of the Red Sea and the reclosing of the Red Sea are no more unlikely than the events of Job chapter 1. And in both cases, we don't need to strain our credulity to believe them, because the Bible text says, no, this is not a coincidence. This is the divine hand of God at work. So yes, things have happened very, very specifically and precisely according to a preordained plan. Additionally, in terms of the very prearranged style of the speeches, the fact that each man speaks in sequence, I think perhaps we have to remember that there was a very high formality of the culture of that day. For example, when the friends arrive, they actually sit with Job for 7 days before anyone breaks the silence at all. Okay? So the fact that they sit alone saying nothing for 7 days might be suggestive of a very highly formal culture. Additionally, as we'll see, I think the actual debate in Job went on for a very long time, quite possibly for months, certainly for weeks, because we'll look at why in a minute. But I think the idea of Job's suffering wasn't something that only lasted a few days. There's some good evidence for that in terms of what Job says. So it may well be that there was only a certain day when Job's house was in session to receive speeches or perhaps to deliver speeches, and so each man had actually very carefully prepared his words in highly formalized speech so that he could stand up and be the speaker for the day who gave forth his speech at that time. So that may account for account for the structure that we see in the book of Job, and also for the apparent coincidences. You know, we say one servant arrived while the first one was giving his message. Well, of course, in our culture, which is very informal, we imagine that the delivery of the message was a couple of sentences and that's all it took. But it may have been a long time, it may have been a full day for a servant to deliver an important message to someone of Job's stature. So it may be that what the Bible is saying is that these messengers all arrived on the same day. They may have had to prepare themselves and, you know, have their horses and camels taken care of and wash themselves and eat a meal before they could actually stand up and deliver a message in the house of Job. We just don't know. So there's all sorts of reasons why we don't need to take the evidence for Job being a drama as conclusive that it's not actually real history. Most importantly of all, the fact that unlikely events are not themselves at all unlikely when it's the hand of God that's working. On the other side of the coin, evidence in favor of an historical interpretation. First of all, it's the appropriate biblical default. In other words, we should take the Bible as true and as having actually happened, unless we have good scriptural reason to believe otherwise. And secondly, we find this comment in the prophecy of Ezekiel. Ezekiel chapter 14, God is almost despairing of Israel at this time. I stretch out my hand against Israel, he says, even if these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they could save only themselves by their righteousness, declares the sovereign Lord. And so that presents the character of Job in the context of the character of Noah and the character of Daniel. And so it's very unlikely, therefore, that we're talking about a mythical or legendary character in a play alongside two other characters who have a known history. Noah, for example, is a real character in a real history, and yes, very bizarre things happen during Noah's life, but that doesn't make him any the less real. And the same is true for Daniel, and the same is true for Job. So this natural context of Ezekiel 14 suggests to us that Job was indeed a very real historical character. And so, with that consideration in mind, my conclusion of the authenticity of the book of Job, beyond my faith in God and my insistence that this is the word of God, is that Job really is an historical recount. And there may well be some poetical recapitulation of the speeches that were delivered at the time, but nevertheless, Job is not just a play or a poem. I think a consideration of those things shows us it's real history, and that makes it more powerful for us to know that this man really lived and this man really experienced the things of which we read. As I said, it's perhaps valuable again for the impact of the book to be increased or increased to its appropriate level to realize the time scale of the discourses or the time scale of Job's suffering. First of all, the well-known verse from chapter 2, the three friends sat on the ground with him for 7 days and seven nights. No one said a word because they saw how great his suffering was. So there's a week gone by right there. And if we look at some of the comments of Job, particularly in chapter 19, there's good evidence that this condition of Job has been going on for some time. If it had happened only for a few days, and I imagine this is true in your life, and it's certainly true in mine, that at those times when we're unfortunate enough to be struck with something very severely physically debilitating, we simply crash. And we simply don't go out and you know, for a few days, if a few days is all it takes to get rid of it. But if we look at this, my kinsmen have gone away, says Job. My friends have forgotten me. So I want you to at all times think, you know, how long does it take for this to happen whilst we're reading these comments? My friends have forgotten me. My guests and my maidservants count me a stranger. So Job has guests in his house. So in other words, this is such a long period ongoing that Job is still receiving guests into his house. It's almost like it's a new lifetime condition that he's dealing with, or at least that's how he believes it to be. My servants count me a stranger. They look upon me as an alien. Even the little boys scorn me when I appear. When I appear suggests that Job is actually going out into the marketplace, as it were, out into a society. When I appear, they ridicule me. All my intimate friends detest me. Those I love have turned against me. That's not the kind of thing that happens overnight, one should hope. I am nothing but skin and bones. So physically, he's gone from, let's say, an average condition down to a very wasted physical state. That can't happen very quickly. I have escaped with only the skin of my teeth. So a desperate condition. But I think within that paragraph, we see a lot of evidence to suggest this is an ongoing condition. This has been going on for, at the very least, several weeks and possibly several months that Job has been in this state. So it's appropriate for us to realize that. And then, this is rather an odd graph. I hope this makes sense. What you're looking at here is the words of Job. I simply counted up the phrases that he spoke in order to see the magnitude of him speaking. Here are the chapter numbers of the book down at the bottom. So in chapters 3 and 4 is his first general speech. That gen stands for general, not Genesis. In chapters 6 through 26, I have ignored the words of his three friends, but merely recorded the number of things that Job said, and let me explain more about that in a second. And then chapters 27 to 31, his two other general speeches. Again, the size of the bar indicates the quantity, the number of phrases that he spoke. And what I notice here, particularly looking in the middle section in chapters 6 through 26, when he's talking to the three friends, in blue above, I've shown how much he said to each different friend. And it's roughly similar. He says just about as much to Eliphaz as ever he does to Bildad, as ever he does to Zophar. But when we actually divide it up differently and say, well, why, since he spoke to each of the three friends three times, with the exception of Zophar a third time, then we can say, how much did he say to any of them on the first time around? How much did he say to any of them on the second time around? And how much on the third time around? And the interesting thing we find is that there's quite a lot of arithmetic symmetry in this book. Not that I really understand why. There's roughly 100 phrases said to each of the three friends. Equally, there's almost exactly 100 phrases spoken in the second round, and there's 100 phrases in Job's third general speech. And yet, there's also some good exponential ratios. There's almost exactly double 100 in the first round, and almost exactly half 100 phrases in the third round. And equally, in the general speeches, they're pretty much doubled in length. So the second general speech is almost exactly double the length of the first general speech, and the third to the second has the same ratio. So the account is relayed with some great arithmetic beauty. It's not immediately clear to me why, but this is sculpted as a very fine story, and perhaps that's testament also to the sheer length of time that this has been going on, that God wants to imprint that on our minds with the great care with which he presents the tale. Lessons deriving from that, just stripping away the details, lessons deriving from this are not easy to find. Let's just clean up a bit and shove them all over to one side. But perhaps what we can see is this. Our observations are, there is an exponential decrease in the comments to each of the three friends, yet there's no discrimination between the friends. In other words, one friend seems just as much as good as another. Or in fact, in this case, just as much as bad as another. Doesn't seem to be any, you know, they're all three the same in this analysis. But as time goes on, Job speaks less and less to these comforters that will not comfort him. And he speaks more and more to the world or to the Lord. He just appeals much more in general. He kind of gives up, and with good reason, on actually trying to convince his friends of anything. So the distinction we find is between the rounds of speeches rather than between the friends themselves. There's an increasing appeal of injustice. It's like he can't get through to his friends, so he appeals more and more to the Lord. And if that's true, and if that should strike in our lives, we're left with the possibility that in times of adversity, too often our only comfort is in the Lord. So is that bond strong? You know, is God someone we know well? Are we someone God knows well? And the fact that he formed us in the womb is not what I'm talking about. Have we built up a relationship with God where we can say, yes, this is a familiar talking partner that I have. Should adversity strike, he knows me well. I have often come before him in times of ease and established that good relationship with him so that I feel I can call upon him in times of trouble. These are just kind of preliminary thoughts that come to mind when we look at the structure of the book of Job. I'm also going to spend a little bit of time looking at the time and place of the setting of the book. And you might think, well, that's obviously just filler material because you can't fill five talks or something. And no, it's not. I think there's actually some genuine spiritual value in understanding the time and the placement of the book of Job. So bear with me just a couple of slides, and then hopefully I'll be able to show you what I believe that is. Here's a comment from the very end of the book. After this, Job lived 140 years. He saw his children and their children to the fourth generation, a seemingly meaningless detail of genealogy, and yet that detail alone lets us do some very vague placement, and that is that Job lived after the flood. How do we know that? Well, just at the rate of aging and the rate of childbirth and the rate of reproduction that was going on before and after the flood was very different. If you needed to see four generations of your children before the flood, on average, you'd have to live 410 years. If you wanted to see four generations of your children after the flood, then on average, you'd have to live 125 years. So the fact that four generations of Job's children, subsequent children, took place within 140 years is just about perfect to say that it was sometime after the flood and certainly not before. So we can't put Job before the flood. He's not that early. We know he's a very early character in the Bible, But he's not so early as to be antediluvian. We do have a case to make that he is after the flood. First detail. This is perhaps where we can narrow things down a lot more definitely, and this is a family tree. You got Abraham there at the top in yellow, and Nahor, his brother, over to the right. Two of Abraham's wives, Sarah and Keturah, from whom he has Isaac, amongst others, and Shua, respectively. And as we follow the family tree of Isaac down, we find some very familiar names showing up. Firstly, here's Teman, and remember that Eliphaz is a Temanite. And in fact, by the time Teman comes along, Eliphaz is already a family name. You can see that Teman's father was, in fact, named Eliphaz. And this is the only mention of a character named Teman in all of the Bible, by the way, so we're not just picking up a random one. And about the same time, if we follow the line of promise through Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, and through the tribe of Benjamin, one of Benjamin's sons was named Naaman, one of only three characters in the Bible called Naaman, and he is pretty much contemporary with the man Teman. Remember, of course, Zophar was a Naamathite. And Keturah, Abraham's wife, gave birth to a son named Shua, the only man in the whole Bible called Shua, and therefore from whom the Shuites derived. And so with that, we can actually find the origins, the sort of tribal origins, if you will, of the three friends of Job, Eliphaz the Temanite, Zophar the Naamathite, and Bildad the Shuhite. And just in case we were interested, we can also find the origin of Elihu, the fourth man who shows up, the somewhat enigmatic character, descended from the line of Nahor. In fact, if you look at Genesis chapter 21, it's the very end of the book. Well, I don't see it now. Well, let's try Genesis chapter 22 then. That might help. The very end of the chapter, Genesis chapter 22, and you can see that little paragraph starting at verse 20. It's only two or three verses long. It just says Nahor's sons. It's just, and it seems an absolute anachronism that that is tacked on. You've got some really interesting prose going on, some interesting story development of what Abraham's doing at Beersheba. And there's a few verses just thrown into the end of the chapter. So, oh, and by the way, Nahor had some sons, and their names were Uz and Buz. And you think, well, so what? And it's not very useful to the story at the time, but it's very handy in helping us identify all of the characters in Job, Eliphaz, Zophar, Bildad, and Elihu, and none other than, perhaps, of course, Job himself. Don't forget that the opening verse of the book, in the land of Uz, there lived a man whose name was Job. So we at least have a setting also for the book of Job. Does that prove that Job was of the genealogy of Uz? No, it doesn't prove that. It suggests if he might have been, since he was a rich man, he was presumably well established in that area, but that's not necessarily true either, because some rich men lived nomadic lives, Abraham, for example. So we can't be sure of the genealogy of Job, but nevertheless, we have found the genealogical sort of origins of the characters. So we know that this took place some time after Abraham. Okay? Why is this of any spiritual value? I think it's useful. Yesterday we were able to demonstrate, I hope, that Eliphaz and Zophar and Bildad had each upon themselves, or within themselves, developed the spirit of Satan. And so we learn the origins of Satan. Abraham. Now, that's a little bit of an extrapolation, but you see my point. Abraham is the child of promise. From where did the Messiah come? Well, God, of course. But from where did the Messiah come? The Messiah came through the line of Abraham. Right. And this is useful for any of us who think we are children of promise to know. Where did Satan come from? The same place. Absolutely. They're intertwined and inseparable. The moment you've got humans, even humans who think, perhaps even rightly, that they're children of promise, Satan is right there with them. And so I think it's useful that right from the book of Job, one of the very early books of the Bible, chronologically, you're shown that the origins of the opponent, that which opposes God, are inextricably interwoven with the origins of the line of promise itself. Elihu, by contrast, is a Gentile. He's not a child of Abraham. And nor, suggestively, is Job, but we can't be sure on that latter point. So I think that's why it's useful to do things like chasing the genealogy of these men to understand some scriptural lessons. Here's our final point in terms of addressing the timing of the book of Job, and that is Job is clearly aware of the Exodus event. He's aware that the Israelites came out of Egypt, and specifically, he's aware of the crossing of the Red Sea. And these are the verses that are suggestive of that, and if you read them and think that I've been set out in the sun too long, I don't blame you, because it's not very apparent, and the relation to the Red Sea event is very oblique. But by using some words in Isaiah, I hope we're going to make it nice and firm. So, particularly the top one, Job 26, in one of Job's speeches, the pillars of the heavens quake, aghast at his rebuke. By his power, he churned up the sea. By his wisdom, he cut Rahab to pieces. By his breath, the skies became fair. His hand pierced the gliding serpent. Now that is fairly abstract. It is not clear to see the crossing of the Red Sea there, perhaps except by the faintest parallel, and a similarly oblique reference in Job 9. But allow me to throw in these translations from the later prophecy of Isaiah that help us understand exactly what Job was saying. And this is Isaiah 30. That unprofitable nation, Egypt, whose help is utterly useless, therefore I have called her Rahab the Do-Nothing. So this name Rahab, by the way, it's by Hebrew word, has nothing to do with that faithful woman in Jericho. That's a different name entirely. Rahab is the name given to Egypt. And here in Isaiah 51, we can see the same sort of allegorical story that Job was obviously referring to earlier. And this here, it's a little bit more clear that it's the crossing of the Red Sea that's being referred to. Awake, awake, calls Isaiah. Clothe yourself with strength, O arm of the Lord. Awake as in days gone by, as in generations of old. Was it not you who cut Rahab to pieces, who pierced that monster through? Was it not you who dried up the sea, the waters of the great deep, who made a road in the depths of the sea so that the redeemed might cross over? So there now we have a very clear reference. We can understand very clearly Isaiah 51 refers to Israel coming out of Egypt through the Red Sea. And the idea of cutting Rahab, Egypt, to pieces, piercing that monster through, is the same language, obviously, that it was remembered in the time of Job. You can see Job is clearly saying the same words as Isaiah 51, although Isaiah came later, of course, but that's how the children of Israel remembered that event, in terms of Rahab, the sea serpent, being cut through by the hand of the Lord. So Job is aware of the Exodus event. And that's what I'd like to suggest, therefore, that that's the latest that we can date Job, and therefore I'd like to suggest to you that the actual time period of Job, and perhaps this is where it becomes important, Israel are wandering in the wilderness. That's what's going on. In fact, it might well be, and for reasons that we're going to show later, that I think Deuteronomy 28 has already been spoken, Israel have already been rebuffed from entering the promised land. They are in that 40 years of wandering. So it's not just that Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar have themselves taken on the spirit of Satan and are themselves Satan to Job, but that Job is in the wilderness when he is tempted by Satan. He has been led by the Spirit of God to be in the wilderness to be tempted of the devil. And we can see very strong patterns, very slowly and gently climbing out of the text. Here's a little bit of geography just to make sure we can understand where Uz is, because it's not immediately clear. Several sites have been proposed. This is a picture taken not from an aeroplane, but from a satellite. It's fantastic spatial and spectral resolution, given that that's its origin. This is the Mediterranean Sea. You can see that dark area up to the top left there, and the island of Cyprus is quite nicely shown. And so here is the Promised Land, and just south of the Promised Land. That's the Dead Sea there. I'm sorry, I don't have a pointer. And so I'm not going to be tall enough to show you the Sea of Galilee, but you can follow up and see it right there. And so Israel is against the coastline there. You can see the waves breaking on the Mediterranean shore. And this is Egypt and the Jordan. Jordan is here. And Syria is up in the top right. And so, and these are the mountains of Edom, just down to the south of the Promised Land. Okay? So from the Exodus, Israel would have been driving north through this region up from Sinai, and eventually they would enter the land through the conquest of Joshua, just north of the Dead Sea. That was their point of passage across the River Jordan. Where then is Uz? Several sites are proposed. During their 40 years of wandering, they would have covered all of this ground, so which one is accurate doesn't really matter. But most of the geological scholars and the historical scholars would place Uz in one of these two regions, both of which are in the mountains of Edom. So this is the territory of Edom down here. That is the desert part in which ours is thought to be. We have a little clue from Eliphaz that there are many many strangers wandering through this land at that time, and I think that would be a very appropriate comment to make if you've got 500,000 visitors trekking through from east to west or something. So the basic point is that Uz is outside the promised land. It's in the desert, it's in the wilderness, it's not in the land of promise. That's all we really need to know. And potentially Israel are prior, in fact almost certainly, Israel are prior to their Canaan entry, therefore, to be there in the land of Uz. Doubtless after, we'll see reasons for that in a minute, it's after they've been rebuffed at the first time, so the time period of Uz, of Job, comes to be during the 40-year wandering in the wilderness. Let's just see the bigger picture of that. Again, another fantastic satellite picture. Israel now, I hope you can see, doesn't show all of Israel. The Dead Sea is up in the top right, so Israel is actually that darker patch of green-brown land that heads off to the very north here, and this is the Sinai Peninsula here in the middle, and over here is the land of Egypt. This is the Nile River, this dark line, flowing from south to north, flowing with milk and honey, because you can see, even from the satellite picture taken in modern times, that there is a fertility in that area that is not present in massive areas of the surrounding countryside. Just a little anecdotal reference, if you are teaching in Sunday school about the land flowing with milk and honey, as I was taught many years ago, please bother to point out that that is metaphorical. You may have a little four-year-old boy sat there thinking, what a mess. Imagining milk and honey flowing over the ground, thinking, how do you keep that out of your house? You know, doesn't milk go sour after a few days? So just for those of you teaching the early stories, do remember you may have a very well-meaning but dim-witted literalist sat there who's afraid to speak up. So bother to point out what all that's about, will you? There. And I think now if we look at this land and this geography and some of the Bible stories that are associated with it, we can place the book of Job within a bigger framework, which is useful to see. And I've mentioned the books of the Bible, and I've shown them by color here as I'll plan out the little chronology of what's going on. We're going to start in Bethel. Bethel is the house of God. And Jacob and his sons, essentially, and Abraham, who all spend time there, you know, speaking very broadly now, whizzing through chapters at a glance, depart from the house of God in Genesis 35. A famine in the land, a drought drives them out. You can see why, even from the satellite picture, if there ever was a famine in that area, you'd all head for the Nile Delta, because that is the greenest, the richest part. It's where the water is, it's where the food is. So you can understand now, even from science, how the Bible stories have operated, or how, at least how humans have behaved in time past. So there is a departure from the house of God, and the children of Israel, Jacob and his sons, are led into Egypt. They're preceded by the son Joseph, who goes before them as a pioneer and a type of Christ, and has power even in Egypt. Lots of figures there we have no time for, sadly. And that's pretty much our story in Genesis. And the text is picked up in the book of Exodus, where, as the name implies, and I've shown it in the blue color, they leave Egypt and they cross the desert, and they cross the Red Sea, and they head down towards Sinai, and I realize I haven't put it in the canonical place, no time to explain about that. And then after receiving the law at Sinai, they drive northwards en route to the land flowing with milk and honey that the Lord God has promised them. And so that's really the geography of the book of Exodus. And finally, the conquest into the land from the east across the Jordan, and they end up returning to Bethel, and they come back to Bethel in Joshua chapter 8. So from Genesis 35 to Joshua chapter 8, there is this closed loop of being in the house of God, leaving the house of God, being in captivity and slavery because you've left the house of God, wandering through the wilderness because you've left the house of God, and finally through a conquest of faith, returning to the house of God, Joshua chapter 8. My point being that Uz is en route. And so what happens in the book of Job is certainly in this desert time. The theme of Job, therefore, the children of God are tempted and wandering in the desert in the time that they pass through the land of Uz. That's the point of just seeing the bigger picture of one of the many threads that's going on through Scripture of where the book of Job fits in, both geographically and, more importantly, spiritually in terms of that story. Children of God have not yet found their way back to communion with their Father. And let's not, in all of this science and geography, lose sight of the hideous circumstance of the man Job. And really, it does take the student should take time to read the entire book to get the depth and breadth of the horror of the circumstance of this man. Here's one verse, perhaps, that strikes me particularly. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and afflicted Job with painful sores from the soles of his feet to the top of his head. Then Job took a piece of broken pottery and scraped himself with it as he sat among the ashes. I've just underlined that one phrase, the piece of broken pottery. Perhaps as a little exercise, perhaps each of you could just reach down and pick up a piece of broken pottery. Can anyone do that? I'm getting blank looks, but nothing else. I understand why. Is there any broken pottery in the room, please? Good answer. No, effectively no. And in other words, Job is a rich man. There isn't broken pottery to hand. So you could, it's just a statement of pathos to realize that what he's doubtless done is he's reached around and found some pottery, don't worry, and in order to, you know, he's just smashed his own stuff to find something to ease his pain. He's taken a vase of his or a plate or something, and such is the desperation of his condition. He's had to smash it to get a piece of broken pottery and scrape the sores on his skin. And that really is a comment which I think reflects just how low this poor man had sunk. Well, not sunk, but been brought down by the intentional circumstance that God had placed upon him. Again, just to expand on that, not for the trying to sort of glory and revel in that which is gory or gruesome, but so that we might understand and really sympathize with the condition of Job, realize how much he had been struck, realize that he had not been struck just with depth, but also with incredible breadth. That is, every feature of his being had been afflicted. The physical, the emotional, the social, the personal, and the spiritual. I cite an example of each so that you realize I'm not just throwing out words at random. Physically, the night drags on, says Job, and I toss till dawn. My body is clothed with worms and scabs. My skin is broken and festering. So physically, he's been reduced to a painful, disgusting state that he himself can barely bear. Emotionally, yet, he still feels pain. He says, if only my anguish could be weighed, it would surely outweigh the sand of the seas. That is his anguish at what's going on. I don't think that's necessarily related directly to his physical pain, although the two will couple naturally, but that is an emotional anguish at the situation he finds himself in. Socially, their sons mock me in song, says Job. I have become a byword among them. Another testament that this hadn't happened overnight. You don't become a byword or a known word of anything unless you've been in that condition for a long time. I have become a byword among them. They do not hesitate to spit in my face. And I don't know whether he's speaking physically or metaphorically there, and it barely matters. Such is the social level of destruction visited upon Job. Personally, just at his very personal, most intimate relationships, my breath is offensive to my wife. I am loathsome to my own brothers. So even personally, everything that he's been able to enjoy in the inner sanctum of his being and his relationships have also been stripped away from him and denied him. And spiritually, perhaps the most painful of all to a truly blameless and righteous man, his God, or his understanding of his God as a loving father, has been changed. I cry out to you, O God, but you don't answer me. I stand up. You merely look at me. You turn on me ruthlessly. With the might of your hand, you attack me. This is the full breadth and depth of the suffering of Job. And we do well to take some time just to reflect upon those and their associated passages to realize just what this man, the state this man is in when he is called to give replies and rebuttals and responses to the attacks he receives from Satan, his three prosecutors. This prompts then the cry of Job, may the day of my birth perish, and the night it was said a boy is born. May darkness and deep shadow claim it once more. May a cloud settle over it, may blackness overwhelm its light. May it not be included among the days of the year, nor be entered in any of the months. May that night be barren. May no shout of joy be heard in it. May those who curse days curse that day, those who are ready to rouse Leviathan. And Leviathan is a character that will feature quite prominently in some of our talks to come, and it's interesting to see what Job thinks of Leviathan even now. In his very first general speech, as early as chapter 3, he associates this creature, Leviathan, whatever it may be, with something that needs something that's to do with curses. It's a bad and evil thing. And he's saying, those who celebrate this activity rouse Leviathan. And we'll see to what extent Job offers an unwitting prophecy in that statement. And let's not overfocus. Having focused in on Job, and seen the depth and breadth of his suffering and the depth and breadth of his destruction and condition, how much more must that impinge upon us, my dear brothers and sisters, when we sit together quietly as we do and break bread and wine on a regular basis? For there is one man who was brought lower yet and who was beaten with more stripes, and we sit in remembrance of him every week, or at least we should. That being the case, then, brothers and sisters, and I don't have many words to say, I don't even know what words to say, but somehow, even as we study Job, and if we think Job is some icon of suffering, then we need to take all of those thoughts and ensure that they are correctly transposed onto our appreciation of the sacrifice of the Lord Jesus Christ at all such times that we come together to remember him. Amidst that, we have the character of Job, which shines like a light in darkness, and it's a beautiful thing to see. And so, even though by chapter 19, what is he replying to Bildad, I think, for the second time, it hardly matters. He's been attacked time and again by his friends, as we will see. He says these words, "Oh, that my words were recorded," says Job, "that they were written on a scroll, that they were inscribed with an iron tool on lead, or engraved in rock forever. I know that my Redeemer lives, and that in the end he will stand upon the earth, and after my skin has been destroyed, yet in my flesh I will see God. I myself will see him with my own eyes, I and not another. How my heart yearns within me." One thing that still had not faded, though all of his physical and emotional capacities were reduced or taken away, was the vision he had before him of that which is coming. The depth to which he understood the details of this vision are not given to us, and therefore we need spend no time in pursuing them. Suggestions have been made that Job was calling for a witness in his current life to stand up and defend him in the court of God, and therefore that Job had no concept of the resurrection. That's been published quite recently in a number of different volumes, and the comparison is made with chapter 7 in order to establish that, where Job speaks of death being the end of his days. But I don't think that's valid, brothers and sisters. I don't think that's valid at all. We can see within those words in great detail that he knows that after his flesh has been destroyed, in his flesh, he will see God with his own eyes. He's very specific about the physical reconstruction that he knows can happen to his form. How he has come to know that matters not. But the important thing is not even that he knows it. It is that he clings to it when everything else is gone. He doesn't throw it out the window in bitterness or scorn. He clings to that one thing as the one shining light that he has left in front of him. This is the character of the man that we are privileged to be able to study together today and indeed this week. That being said, we have 3 minutes remaining, and that's all we need just to spend a minute looking at each of the three friends. Just in terms of introducing their character, the content of the debate and the arguments proper, we will consider tomorrow. But let's just introduce ourselves so that we can have some distinction or memory between the three friends themselves. Firstly, Eliphaz. Who is Eliphaz? He's a Temanite. What does that mean? Teman is from Esau. So, Eliphaz is an Edomite. Who is Edom? He is the man who supplied no comfort when the children of God were in the wilderness. First of all, let's consider the origin of his name, Red. Once when Jacob was cooking some stew, Edom came in from the open country, famished. He said to Israel, "Quick, let me have some of that red stew. I'm famished." So Edom despised his birthright. The redness of the stew was in part the reason for the giving of his name as Edom, in part at least. But the important spiritual point is there. He had an honored position, and he rejected it. Now, what we've reasoned from the land or the geography of the land of Uz is that Uz is in the mountains of Edom. So Eliphaz is a local. So he has local power and position. Perhaps that's why he speaks first among the three friends. Many reason it's because he's the eldest. Maybe that's true too or not. I don't know. But I do know he's a local. And so therefore he has position among the community that some or all of the others might not. He has an honored position. And here is more of what we learn of Edom, the character of Edom. The children of God implore Edom for help in Numbers 20. This is what your brother Israel says. You know about all the hardships that have come upon us. Think how well that sentence reflects Job's condition. You know about all the hardships that have come upon us. Please, let us pass through your country. Edom replies, you may not pass through here. If you try, we will march out and attack you with the sword. That was Edom's behavior towards Israel, and Eliphaz is an Edomite. Perhaps it is no surprise whatever, then, that when we see Job appealing to Edom for help and assistance, saying, you can see all the hardships that have come upon me. You can see my flesh hanging off me. This is how Eliphaz replies. First of all, he replies well. He has an honored position, just like Esau. Think how you have instructed many, Job. How you have strengthened feeble hands. Your words have supported those who stumbled. You have strengthened faltering knees. But as time goes on, he despises that honored position of being Job's comforter. And just like his grandfather or his great-grandfather before him, he rejects that position of honor and takes instead the position of providing no comfort for Israel in the wilderness. You demanded security from your brothers for no reason. You stripped men of their clothing, leaving them naked. You gave no water to the weary, and you withheld food from the hungry. And you sent widows away empty-handed and broke the strength of the fatherless. That is why snares are all around you, why sudden peril terrifies you. Such is the character of Eliphaz. And 30 seconds on each of the others shows that Bildad and Zophar are no better. Bildad, also a child of Abraham, he has deliberately noted the suffering condition of Job, and he has created a hypothetical wicked man who has suffered all of the same things. Fire in his tent, just as the fire fell on Job's sheep. A disease which eats away part of his skin, which he can see happening to Job in front of him. And that his children will be killed, just as Job's children were killed. Surely such is the dwelling of an evil man, Bildad wrongly concludes. Such is the place of one who knows not God. And Zophar, who is actually an Israelite, of the line of promise through Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, can do no better at all. Surely God recognizes deceitful men. And when he sees evil, does he not take note? If you put away the sin that's in your hand, no one will make you afraid, and many will court your favor. It's the idea of John chapter 9. Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Zophar, like all the others, needs to learn the answer to that question. And so tomorrow, by the end of this class, we've established that the children of God are wandering in the wilderness as they wrestle with Satan. We found Satan in the first class. We found the wilderness journey in the second. Tomorrow we'll see the debate proper as the righteous man struggles with being tempted by the devil in the wilderness journey.